You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out WeKnowPodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, WeKnowPodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This is the How Did It Take Us This Long edition, and we are talking about Event Horizon. Scott, I think we all considered picking this for many, many years. We even did it as one of our old school, like, hey, let's watch movies for 12 hours on Twitch live streams, specifically the one where Brian was almost dead asleep because of some airplane issues.
Oh, man. I absolutely forgot, because, like, Megan, I was like, Megan, we watched Event Horizon. She was like, which one is that? And I'm like, oh, it's Hell in Space. And you know, Sam Neill and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, I guess I remember that. And I said, yeah, it's really good for the first hour. I actually forgot that we watched that in that live stream when Brian was here.
But you know why you forgot that we watched that during the live stream? That was the movie that was on when we went outside to take the photos.
Oh, okay. I don't feel so stupid.
I'm going to put this out there. Obviously, I don't think we can do it in time for episode 350 because that is quickly approaching. But I think this summer, it's time for us to, if we're not going to do a ton of conventions still, maybe it's time for us to all converge to one location for a live stream event or something.
I would love
that. I think
that'd
be fun.
Absolutely.
So the only thing I'm going to say about Event Horizon before I pass it over to Scott, who picked it, is that this was also going to be on my list for more of the reason that this is the 25-year anniversary of Event Horizon. Came out in 1997, and what a flop it was. I was shocked how badly this did in its box office release, but classic cult, classic type situation where it hit video stores and the people who this movie was made for found it.
The craziest thing about it failing was that, a direct quote, the film was a commercial and critical failure, grossing $42 million on a $60 million production budget, which is, that's crazy. But the other crazy thing for me is that Kurt Russell was in Paul W.S. Anderson's next movie after this, and he got to see an advanced copy of Event Horizon, and he was like, don't worry about how it does in the theaters because this is going to be a classic. And he was right. I mean, but the thing about this is that it was rushed. Like, writing of it was rushed. The production was rushed. The editing was rushed. That's why Paul W.S. Anderson lost, like, so he did his original director's cut, and it was too long. Apparently, it was like 2 hours or 2 hours and 10 minutes,
yeah,
or something.
2 hours and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Is what I
yeah.
That's a haul.
And, well, I mean, I would have been fine with that because, like, I think that it needed that. And I'll get to why in a minute here. But the studio hated that cut. And maybe, like, test audiences hated that cut. So he cut it down to an hour and 30, 2 minutes. I mean, like something, it's really, really short in my opinion for all the high concept that you get out of it. Like, cause it's a high concept sci-fi horror movie. I mean, like, I think that it really, right. It does, the pacing is so good for the first hour and then it falls to shit when it becomes a slasher in space, which is also the same problem that happened with Sunshine, which came out, I don't know, maybe a decade after this. I think that this movie is such a great concept. And it's so funny because every single time I've watched this movie, and I think that this is only my third full watch of it, because I watched it in 97 or 98, right when it hit VHS, I rented it from the video store, took it home because I knew all about the concept. I was like, mm-hmm. Hell in space? That's so my jam. You know, like I'm, you know, 14 years old and or whatever, and I'm just like all about it. And I'm into it. I am so unnerved by the visions of hell scene, you know, when they watch the disc,
yeah.
And then Sam Neill gets killed and becomes literally Jason X. And I remember in my innocence being like, why did this movie stop being good in that last half hour? And as an adult, I'm like, oh, it's because I feel like somebody or some panel of people at the studio were like, you know what this needs? It needs more action.
I think I read four different times between IMDb and Wiki that the gore was so uncomfortably extreme,
oh, yeah.
And that people fainted during test screenings by how graphic it was, that was all of the first stuff to go.
Yeah.
So I feel like you're right. It was probably, it was building up to something that we never fully get in the end. So we're just getting like the bits and pieces. And I mean, honestly, in a weird way, like you said, add more action. But I think, like, what is a horror movie without its goring kills but an action movie?
I don't agree with that.
If you think about, like, even a Friday the 13th movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you made a Friday the 13th movie where you never see the gore and you never actually see the kill, you just kind of do the quick cutaway, I think that movie's going to look way more like the traditional action movie looks, where it's all about
Fair.
The buildup to the violence than the actual delivery of the violence.
Sure.
Whereas, like, that's like what separates horror from so many other genres, is that you get that delivery of the violence. I want to talk about Paul W.S. Anderson for a second, because dude's career, I want to say it's a sad one, but it's an interesting one to me. So he makes Mortal Kombat, becomes like the golden boy, right? Like, Mortal Kombat does gangbusters.
They want him to do the X-Men movies.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. So they offer him all this stuff, but he wanted to, he said he wanted to, like, not be pigeonholed as like a PG-13 mm-hmm. action director. He wanted to do a hard R horror movie. That was something that was important to him. Right. So he makes Event Horizon, and the movie with Kurt Russell he was making was Soldier.
Yes. Thank
which
you.
Interesting thing about Soldier is that it's a Blade Runner sequel. Most
what?
People don't know that, but it is
to me.
It is Jonathan London tipped me off on that. And there's now a whole wiki page, all the connections to Blade Runner. It was written as a Blade Runner sequel. Kurt Russell's character in that movie is a replicant, basically.
Oh, okay.
But those movies both fucking tank, right?
Yeah.
So it's another 4 years before he directs something again, and it's Resident Evil. So they bring him back for another video game
yeah.
movie. They're like, all right, let's give this guy a video game movie. That movie does well. He does Aliens versus Predator. And then the rest of his career is really strange to me, because I'm looking at it and it's a bunch of movies that I vaguely remember. But I feel like, despite the fact that the wiki says that these movies did amazing in the box office, I would be hard pressed to find any human being that would say, yes, I remember seeing that movie in theaters. But every single one of them is followed by another Resident
That's
Evil movie.
Because, Matt,
almost,
you're forgetting about the Chinese market. Resident Evil
That's
is
true.
Huge
because,
in
cause,
Asia.
Well, because what I was going to say is that it's like this movie bombed, so then he had to do a Resident Evil movie to get a win, and then did another movie that bombed, and he had to do a Resident Evil movie to get a win. But all three of the movies that I thought bombed did double their box office, and it was the Death Race remake with
Jason Statham.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Three Musketeers movie from 2011.
Oh, God, that
and Pompeii
awful.
From 2014.
Those, it's the Asian market.
This is
dude.
The best Paul W.S. Anderson movie by a mile. But like,
well, it's also because Philip Eisner is the name of the guy who wrote, or he pitched and then wrote the treatment for Event Horizon, and mm-hmm. he hasn't done as much. I mean, like, it's because I checked out Paul W.S. Anderson's IMDb, and you know, it's very interesting how your reaction was compared to mine, because mine was like, dang, he must really like working with Mila Jovovich. And then I'm like, oh, they're married.
Oh, they're married.
But then Philip Eisner, I read it, read his IMDb, and it's very sparse. This is Philip Eisner's elevator pitch for Event Horizon: The Shining in space, which is not bad. Yeah. I mean, like, I think that it really got a lot of treatments beyond his original draft, I'm sure, because the stuff that really makes it rich and awesome to me is, I'll do it in like the levels of how awesome I think they are, starting with the most awesome and
the levels of hell.
Well, in reverse. So if you're like ascending from hell. So the thing that I think is the coolest about this movie that I just found out in reading about it to prepare for this episode is that the quote unquote visions of hell were inspired by Hieronymus Bosch, which is, you know, like the Garden of Earthly Delights, that super weird, I want to say it's 16th century. He's a Renaissance painter, and he did all these like hell landscapes, and they're like triptychs and things like that. And one of my favorite painters from the Renaissance, because it's just so dark. But in that time, you could only do religious stuff. And so he was doing these paintings of hell because he was, you know, like, he's like, I want to paint dark shit. And there are a lot of people with like no heads, but faces in their chests, and, you know, people being tortured by animals and all this. And so good. So that is the thing that I found the most interesting. But then the next thing I thought was super cool was that this is also inspired by Warhammer.
Yep. I saw that. That's dope.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, specifically Warhammer 40,000.
Yeah.
The space version of Warhammer, because Warhammer traditionally is more of like a D&D type game.
It's high fantasy. This and Warhammer 40K is like, you know, it's the sci-fi version. And I was shocked because I had no idea that Warhammer predated Event Horizon, you know, because that you know, I remember people playing 40K. Like, I remember the little figures and stuff like that. And it just felt like that was a high school thing for me, not a would have ostensibly been an elementary thing for me to inspire this film. But then the other thing I loved was that they originally had the Gateway Drive be like this giant, smooth, featureless black orb. Then Paul W.S. Anderson, he was like, no, let me redesign it to have interlocking circles. It's supposed to be the puzzle box from Hellraiser, which is wild.
That's awesome.
And then also the last and most obscure thing I found out about this inspiration-wise is that they literally took a sound from Doom, the video game, and used it as the sound when doors open in it. It's the sound when doors open in the original video game.
Oh my God.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Because my stepdad used to play Doom all the time, and I was enamored with it. But I was also a child. Don't know. But no, dude, that's crazy. Of course, but it's just like more video game inspiration from Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah,
to include away from any of this.
Yeah,
no. Oh my God, that's crazy.
So the other thing that I do think is interesting is that, and I'm sure Scott found this on his research too, but that the original draft, as we were talking about, it's The Shining in space, but it had a lot more of an alien creature in it, and that was like the biggest thing that Paul Anderson said was, he's like, I don't want to just do a mimic movie of Alien.
Right.
Like,
well,
let's do something different.
That would have been really, in my opinion, that would have taken all the spice out of the film. And the thing is that I think that it being not the, I mean, when you think about it as The Shining in space, that's a haunted house movie in space. Yeah. And that's why when Sam Neill's character is now possessed by the hell dimension after he's cut his eyes out and he is like, the ship came back and she's changed. I really like that idea of it being a haunted house. And we don't need an antagonist like Jack, because Sam Neill is basically Jack Torrance, coming after the protagonists. I think that that works on The Shining because that's kind of the whole point of the film and in the book as well. But in this, I like the idea of it being like a presence and not directed into a possession, because I really think that takes away a lot. And haunted house movies rely on that too much, in my opinion. Like, when that when someone becomes possessed in a haunted house movie, I almost always check out. It takes a very special movie like The Conjuring for it to work.
Well, I think that's a great point because you're talking about the occupants of the house or of the spaceship in this instance not being possessed but having to face a certain fear of where they are, right? Yeah. Like, so a lot of these characters are facing baseline, the isolation of space, having to fly past fucking Neptune, which if I were to ever fly in space, which I wouldn't, I would say no, but if I were to have to do so, I would ask not to go past Jupiter. I think that planet's too fucking big to like just agreeably go past it. But like each of these characters, like there's probably brief moments throughout. One character, the mama bear character, with probably the most extensive sort of like, this is your past and this is what you're missing at home arc, right? But of those characters,
they're
has
all dead, that. Right? Like her son's dead.
I didn't register that her son was dead. I registered that those were like, as if we had our phone in space and we're looking through pictures to be like, well, oh, I miss my
what
son.
What I'm
but
seeing is,
I see what you, I see.
I'm thinking that, and this is just in this most recent watch, I think that the implication is that everyone who sees someone on the event horizon is seeing someone that died and they feel guilt about the death. Mm. Like they feel directly responsible for it because Samuel's wife committed suicide and he was like, I miss you so much and I wish I could have fixed it. Lawrence Fishburne's character let somebody on his platoon or whatever burn to death. And so
you're absolutely right. I didn't read it that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
I didn't read
it
that way until this time. So I think that it's left up to your interpretation, but that's I think that that's what the ship is doing is basically instead of showing you your fear, showing you your guilt, which I think is such a great take on what hell would be. Because it's not a scary place. It's a painful place. And the pain of grief and guilt are so, I mean, like, that's also my Catholic upbringing, you know? Like, guilt is so important to, like, the religion. So it's like the guilt of, a survivor's guilt is what it is. It's like all these people, in my opinion, are feeling survivor's guilt in the event horizon. Wow. And then, I think that it would be better if each one of them saw something, but we have characters that don't get fleshed out like that. And that's okay. I mean, but I feel like it also works when the guy saves Baby Bear from the dimension. He pulls him back through the gateway. He feels guilt because he feels like he couldn't save his buddy. But I think that if they had kind of gone with the original concept without having there be a possessed character like Sam Neill to chase him around the ship, we could have gotten a more rich, like a richer backstory for everybody.
So let me defend, I'm not necessarily going to defend the idea of Sam Neill becoming the big bad of this movie, but what I will defend is that it makes sense as a character beat, because the more that Sam Neill spoke about the event horizon throughout this movie, the more I thought, Sam Neill wants to fuck this ship. Literally my only notes that I wrote down besides bad CGI, and I think it was during the one explosion where the first explosion where it's just like pieces of ship and it is rough CGI. And
well, so the crazy thing is that they spent a third of the budget on the first time you see the event horizon. When you see it in front of, when they're doing the backstory, you know, like at the beginning, when you see the event horizon in front of Earth, that's one third of the fucking budget of this movie. And then they were just totally gassed, and they were like, well, I guess we got to make the rest of this movie with, you know, two thirds of the budget. That part looks good, but then when you really, the part that bothered me more is that when you see the Lewis and Clark going up towards the event horizon when they get outside Neptune, I'm like, this just looks bad. And I remember it not looking good in 97 or 98 when I first saw this movie because, you know, I feel like we rose tint CGI in the past, but we also forget that Jurassic Park came out in what, 96?
93.
Oh my God, 93.
5 years removed from Jurassic Park. Yeah. In the hands of the people using it is how good or bad it's going to be. I want to bounce off of what you were just saying. The seeing of that ship was one third of the budget, which This is a $60 million budget movie. That makes that $20 million. The bigger thing about that number is that Kyle could have made 40 movies.
Yeah, please, please give me a third of Event Horizon's budget, like, for the love of God.
Like, that single shot is more movies than Kyle has time on this earth to make.
Those could have been our Mummy movies. We could have made a franchise of Mummy movies, of horror movie night Mummy
You know what
movies.
I want to do is I want to do that Mummy movie and I
horror
still
Mummy
I,
night.
I would love to do a cosmic horror movie as well, because that's what is so good about the beginning of this movie. The first hour is that it's
smart
cosmic
sci-fi, dude.
It's also good, it's basically like Lovecraft in space. And that is my shit. You know, like, give me some jargon, give me some elder gods.
Yeah, and there's some emotion in that, too. There's some actual dense fear and anxiety about your existence. Yeah. Like, that's what, like, really got me. There's moments of that that are like, oh, like, I exist, but I exist so far removed from where I existed. Like, like, do I even exist? Like, it's just, it's crazy questions.
I would totally kill myself. I would blow my shit up if I was going to go to a hell dimension and live for eternity in pain and guilt.
And nobody would know. You would just, they would just think that you were lost on the Event Horizon like 7 years prior, like everybody else did. Like, the whole world thought you like was.
So that's something else that I really appreciate. And this is what I'm going to say about this being smart sci-fi. And I think that it's also what, like, I am not the biggest Star Trek fan. Like, it is not my shit at all. But I appreciate that it is smart sci-fi. What I like about Event Horizon that I never thought about until this viewing is the fact that when he says we're going to get the Event Horizon, they actually fucking know what it is, right? Like, they don't have to have it explained to them. And I know that that seems stupid to point out as like a smart thing, but it's like, how many fucking horror movies or sci-fi movies or anything has characters had to be explained something that should have been the biggest known news?
Yeah,
that makes sense to me, that it's like, oh yeah, like, if a thing just vanished, everybody would know about that. You wouldn't have to have any exposition.
It was the most the biggest space disaster too, is what it said in the in the exposition at the beginning.
So like, we wouldn't even I don't even think you would have needed that exposition in the title if they just reacted that way. But because it's such an uncommon choice, I'm sure that the studio was like,
in 97 exposition, like, world building was in its baby like infancy,
we were all dumb idiots watching movies, needed to tell us what was happening.
And so this is going to be a weird comparison, but they were rushing this movie because they wanted to get it out before Titanic. Everyone knew that Titanic was going to be massive, right? And I feel like the fact that Titanic is a thing in existence when they're making this movie is kind of important, because again, the Titanic, we're only like, what, 2 or 3 years removed from when they first finally found where the ship was, like 50 years after it happened. And it was huge news. So I'm wondering if that helped his case. Like, you know, like, half the people who were even alive when this thing first sank are no longer living. And it's still big news that we're discovering this thing. So 5 years removed from when this shit disappeared, everybody would still know what it was.
I feel like that would definitely be a point in the column, like, if he had to defend it, for sure. And it doesn't, you know, it does feel like it comes with some caveats, but I do no, that's a great point. I do like that a lot, because we just, I don't know, we just trust that crew now. Like, we don't have to be dumb.
Oh yeah, the second that a character was like, "What's the Event Horizon?" all the credibility on that ship is gone.
Well, but it's only strengthened because they see the Visions of Hell video, and Lawrence Fishburne hits stop and goes, "We're leaving." It's unintentionally hilarious, but also exactly what a real person would do. They'd be like, "Fuck this, I'm out." You know?
Yeah, his character is so great because he does truly lead like a captain, right? Like, I don't know, I think that I have a problem with spaceship movies.
Well, because
generally,
the captain's always some evil asshole that's like, doesn't care about his crew, and that is never the actual case in most military situations,
right? And this truly feels like it's pitched like the American military would have a captain commander, and his crew follows Such. You know what I mean? It's like this idealistic way of approaching it, and it works because it's also space. So yes. It's like nobody knows anything about, I mean, even though in this time period they know some things about some things, we as an audience don't know anything about anything. So we also need that captain to be in charge to get us through what's happening here. Quick pitch.
Yeah, let's talk beer real quick.
One thing led to another. It's got a spaceship going on here. It feels very commander in chief on the Event Horizon from Beard in Stonington.
Love it.
But all that to say, I think that like I was really impressed. I don't know if I had seen a Lawrence Fishburne movie. Like I didn't go Matrix. Back and look through his. I never saw Matrix.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which puts me in a weird... I don't know if I should be...
You ever watch Pee-wee's Playhouse?
I don't know if I should be a white millennial male in America, having not seen Matrix, but I am there.
You've seen Dream Warriors, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So we're just...
That was back when he was Larry Fishburne.
That's not a huge part
not
for
a huge
him.
Name. No. And like... I thought he did really well, especially having two opposites, Sam Neill.
At the top of his game.
Like, you know, like, and especially top of his horror adventure, like, big name game, right?
Like, that was
so we're talking Jurassic
1993,
Park.
He became a household name, mm-hmm. and then he just right. was untouchable. And I am shocked that they got him for this and that it didn't do well.
right. Like, and I feel like this could be not a downfall. He didn't go anywhere per se, but it's like, oh, he did his stint.
Well,
Event Horizon happened.
Well, but then Matrix was 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And really, I'm actually kind of shocked as I'm looking at his IMDb credits. I don't think I realized how much voice work he ended up doing instead of acting roles.
Oh, that's
if you
right.
can do that. Oh, if you can do that, do the fucking, you know, like go the VO. Like, do cartoons, yeah. do all that. Do
there's more than you would think for him being a voice, like a voiceover character, is what I'll say.
Each week on the One Hit Thunder podcast, we welcome a special guest to come take a deep dive into a One Hit Wonder artist with us. And together, we decide if that artist brought the One Hit Thunder or was nothing more than a One Hit Blunder. You can find One Hit Thunder anywhere that you listen to podcasts. So hit that subscribe button and join in on the fun each week.
Scott, it's 1997. You're walking into a video store. You're looking at the aisle.
No, I'm not. Not in 1997, buddy.
Okay, whatever year it is that you're looking in the video store. 2020. What video do you? What are you renting?
I'm going from the height of the heavens to the depths of the sea. It's the same movie, just reskinned. Underwater. And it's really funny that you were talking about Titanic because it's also underwater. But Underwater with Kristen Stewart is still one of my favorite recent horror movies. And if we're talking about cosmic horror, that's literally a Cthulhu movie. So, yeah. I mean, we have been talking about double features for 7 years almost at this point. This is one that I feel like I would literally do. I feel like I could sit down and because they're both very short. They're both,
yep.
I think that Underwater is 80 minutes. It's,
yeah, this is a 3 hour experience easily, no
including
problem.
A piss break in the middle.
Yeah.
And it would be so good.
I legit thought that Scott was going to take my answer until the words Underwater came out of his mouth. Not quite the exact same movie.
Almost, though. I know what you're going for.
When I was thinking Event Horizon, I kept also thinking about Deep Rising.
Yep.
The Event Horizon Deep Rising double feature just seems to write itself.
Bad CGI.
Yeah, no, that tracks. I think for me, I have a really rough toss-up because the concept of hell and how it... I don't know, it didn't totally hit home for me in Event Horizon the way I wanted it to.
Sure.
You know what I mean? This was my first viewing, so I was pleasantly surprised. I really, really enjoyed it. But I also felt like the hellscape could have been emphasized a little bit more. So please forgive me or allow me, either way, to do two.
Sure, okay.
One would be Jacob's Ladder, if you were feeling very...
Oh, wow.
Like, if you feel like you needed to... really dive into the psyche of what was happening with the Event Horizon crew, or because I think that there's a purgatory aspect. There's a real hellish fear, and like that's where you live forever, which I feel like would be what happened if you were on the Event Horizon and you succumbed to that issue. But the other one would be Hellraiser 2. Because I think that Julia and Sam Neill's characters are so close in that, and you have a little bit more of a vision of, at least in Hellraiser 2, what that hell is like, due to Julia bringing those souls into that world.
That's also got
to
be our next Hellraiser movie, right? Like, I can't think of any other. That's the only one left. Hellbound.
No, wait, no. Have y'all done Hellworld?
We haven't done Hellworld.
We'll have a lot of fun with Hellworld, should it ever be my choice. Anyway, I Hellraiser 2, I think, really focuses on that hellscape that Hellraiser promises, but doesn't deliver in any other movie. It, depending on how you want to go after you watch Event Horizon or before you watch Event Horizon, those would be my two.
All right, Scott, what have you watched, read, whatever that you want to talk about?
Now, if it's okay with you guys, I want to mention something that I'm in the process of reading and not read. Because it also dovetails with space. So I think you guys both saw this status that I posted on Facebook like a month ago, and I was talking about aliens. I was like, you know, I don't want to sound crazy, but are aliens not from another planet, but rather from another dimension? And, so basically, like, demons or aliens or ghosts or demons or aliens, like, it's all, you know, tied together, and hauntings are basically the same thing as alien abductions, etc. And our good friend Eli commented and said, you need to read the Mothman prophecies. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I knew I've seen the movie, and I was like, he messaged me and was like, I'm not kidding. You really need to watch. You really need to read Mothman Prophecies. I'm like, it's like fiction, right? And he was like, no, it's a journalist interviewing people that have experienced the Mothman. And it is, So I found this website that I, of course, can't remember off the top of my head right now. But it's, there are like 200,000 PDF versions of books out there. And I found this copy of Mothman Prophecies, and I started reading it, and it is a mind bender. I am loving it because it's got like aliens, science fiction, you know, kind of like cosmic horror. It's got time travel. It's got cryptids. It's just a ball of wax, and it is a lot of fun.
That's amazing. My grandma got me Mothman Prophecies, the book, for my birthday, and I just put it on the shelf, and I was like, okay,
let's
grandma,
read it together.
You. Let's start a book club.
Oh, we're starting horror movie night book club. There we go. Honestly,
that would be fun.
Spitballing this. Guys, comment below, but like, would you, if it was part of the Patreon that you did like a book club with the hosts of the podcast, would that be something like incentive?
And we
to,
could
like,
make it, we, if it would only be things that I could find on that PDF site. Like, yeah. It would be free for you. We'll, I mean, you're, obviously you're paying for the Patreon, but you wouldn't be paying on top of that.
Yeah, right. That's out there in the ether if you guys are
interested. That'd be a lot of fun.
I need to read more. Feel like my brain has atrophied over the last 2 years of me not reading as much.
You donate whatever our lowest thing is, that would be entry into this book.
Yeah.
Let us know. Comment on Facebook or send us an email at hmnpodcast@gmail.com. So I want to talk about two documentaries that I watched. Both were delightful. Both had a very interesting premise. I'm going to start with the easier one to explain, and that is a wrestling documentary. It's a doc that's on Hulu called You Cannot Kill David Arquette, about David Arquette's attempt at getting back into professional wrestling about 2 years ago. It is a very well-made doc. It captures a lot of very sad things. It captures a lot of funny things. And you really, it both gives you an appreciation for David Arquette, and it gives you an appreciation for what goes into when you make the decision to be a full-time professional wrestler. What are you actually doing to your body, and what are you doing to your life, essentially? But it's also great because at the same time, he gets fucking shredded. Like, when you see him in the beginning of this movie, he is like, the most dad bod of dad bods, David Arquette. And by the time he's doing these matches, he is just like jacked, like multiple ab jacked, because he's training with DDP, who's like forcing him to work the fuck out. That's a quick recommend there. Netflix. I've heard about this documentary for a while. It got added back on to the site recently. It's called Bathtubs Over Broadway. Have either of you ever heard or seen of this?
No.
Okay. So this one's a little bit harder to explain, but I'll try my best. So it starts at the David Letterman show, Late Night with David Letterman. David Letterman used to do a segment called Dave's Record Collection, where he would show a weird record and they would make a couple jokes about it and maybe play a song. So his head writer, the longest lasting writer for David Letterman, he's been there since the very beginning. One of his jobs was to travel around New York and go to record shops and find weird records for this segment. So while he was doing that, he finds a record called The Bathrooms Are Coming. And he was like, all right, this seems like this fits the bill. So he buys it, and immediately he's looking at the record, and it says, like, gift only, do not sell, like, not for public consumption. And he puts the record on out of curiosity, and it's literally a full-blown Broadway-style musical about how to sell bathroom supplies. And he starts trying to learn more information about it. And basically, in the 60s and 70s, during that Mad Men business sales era, when they would do these yearly sales conventions, they would pay millions of dollars for actual Broadway performers to write, record, and perform a one-night-only Broadway show for the sales team about the company that they work for. And then with some of those things, they would give them like a complimentary soundtrack album.
Yeah, but then we as have those some people, of those.
Yeah, as those people died, their families didn't know what the fuck these records were and just sold them to record stores. So now, like, amongst the record collecting community, they're like a hot commodity because there's only a very finite amount of them. So it's basically about how this writer from David Letterman became obsessed with trying to own every single one of them, but also, like, really cares about preserving them. And, like, became friends with the writers of the songs, became friends with some of the actors and actresses in the song. So it's him interviewing them about, like, what their experiences were back in the day doing this stuff. And apparently now in, like, New York, like, once a month, he puts on a show where, like, he brings up these singers and they, like, play acoustic renditions of the songs from the shows and, like, sign albums for people and stuff. It reminded me a little bit of, like, Best Worst Movie, where you're kind of watching a movie about somebody who thought that they made a very disposable thing that no one would care about, and, like, finding out that there's, like, this gigantic audience. Well, not gigantic, but that there's a very specific dedicated audience that loves and cares about it.
Yeah.
So, and that's another, it's like an hour and 20 minutes on Netflix. It's a quick, easy watch. Some of the songs are fucking catchy as hell.
Yeah.
So, like,
I've heard some of them. I can't remember if this was a podcast.
Bizarre Albums talks about it a lot.
Okay.
That's how I heard about the documentary.
Yeah.
That rules.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Great. It's such a fun little documentary. All right, Kyle, you are the last one, buddy.
Okay. So this sort of dovetails a little bit because I went to a store called The Archive in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Oh, I know that place.
It's Vinegar Syndrome's headquarters. They have obviously all of Vinegar Syndrome catalog for what's available. They also have all their partner labels. They have an amazing used Blu-ray, DVD selection, posters, novels. They have everything. It's an incredible spot. If you're ever in Connecticut, because you can get to anywhere in Connecticut
in
an hour and a half. Okay. Yeah. So just think about that.
And yet you still get to have two senators.
Yeah. Thank you. but they also have, and they just renovated. So upstairs, they have an amazing selection of records. And in the basement, they have a shit selection of records, but they also have an amazing selection of VHS tapes. And so my wife, my son, my best friend Jeanette, and I went over the weekend, and we bought a couple things here and there. But one of the main things that we bought, and which we collect often, are VHS tapes of what we consider Christian cringe. So Bible Man was a big one in our household.
We know about because of Stephen Bay from Analog Jones
Analog
and the
Jones.
Temple of
Finn. He loves
also
the same
loves
stuff.
Bible Man.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So Bible Man, Ginger Brook Fair, and
some
then
McGee
stumbled...
and Me in there. So,
we don't have any McGee and Me yet, but we came across a movie called The Buttercream Gang.
Oh, I've heard had of it. That VHS tape. My mom ordered it in the mail for us one time. I don't think I ever watched it though.
The fucking smile.
Oh God, Kyle, bless. You're okay. Incredible. So The Buttercream Gang was a movie made by or distributed. I don't know if it was distributed or produced by, but let's just say distributed because there was a distribution company run by the Mormon LDS Church called Feature Films for Families. They released a few like adaptations of folk tales, but they've also released sort of some of their own original stories. And this is a movie. You can find it on YouTube. You don't need to like find the VHS tape anywhere. So I'm not talking about something that you can't find, though that would be very Kyle of me to do the piece of shit that it could be sometimes. it's a movie about a gang, obviously filmed in Utah, that is not a gang as you would hear about in your DARE program in elementary school. It's a gang that, according to the back cover of the VHS, like helps women churn their butter, but in actuality that does not help it. Does not happen.
Can I read the one sentence review that came up for Google?
Yeah.
Or description? It just says, a gang of do-gooders refuse to give up on a friend who falls in with the bad crowd.
Yes, yes, yes. And the bad crowd in this movie is blatantly pitched to be a Hispanic gang out of Chicago. Hispanic is emphasized, so much so that the gang member who moves from the Buttercream Gang, the do-gooders, to Chicago for, I don't know how long, a couple months, joins a gang. The paper reads, local Hispanic gang does bad or something. He wears a collared shirt with just the top button
oh my God.
Open. And he changes his last name to Valdez, which is his mom's maiden name. So, like, they're really, like, it's fucking racist. It's also the whitest movie I've ever seen. And so, like, I don't know. I don't want to go off too much because I will. So I'd like to just say, if you are interested in the way that, and it's not even Christian cringe. I mean, we're talking Mormonism. We're talking, like, an actual Christian sect. So we're talking a couple steps in a different,
very
like
the
family tree of Christianity is a little, it's a branch over here, right? So like we're talking a very specific branch of it. Sure. However, there's a lot of overlap, and if you're interested in religious family content that is not yours, I would highly recommend watching it. It did feel like I was in a portal to another dimension, and I was like, oh, there's literally families that only watch films like this.
Yeah.
Like there are families and groups of people that do not watch any other
thing. Also homeschool their fucking kids.
They also exactly. And the whole gang were little chunky white kids, and it's so funny because there's a whole segment of them playing baseball, and it's like not to like objectify these kids, but it's like they are just chunky pasty white kids, and they put them in the baseball uniforms for like 2, 3, 4 scenes, and it's just like I don't know, like,
have
not that you can't be chunky
baseball?
And do your thing, but it's like it feels almost exploitative how much
just like,
they focus on their chunk.
Listen, they're the good American kids. They got to play the all-American sports.
Oh, the Red Sox versus the Braves is the baseball game. We watch the baseball game. Don't
Jesus
you worry. There's
Christ.
A whole fucking scene.
God.
I watched that. I'll go off. It's really terrible. But it's also a portal. It's a complete portal into a environment of which I am not familiar. And it really reads like, oh my God, this is all the content that age child would have watched if they were in that group, in that family. Like if they were in that religion, that's what they would watch. And it's just mind boggling. When you like take that and realize the ripple effect of it, you're like, oh, this is insanity.
You know, listeners, there's a little bit of everything for you here. We got a real in the weeds discussion about Event Horizon for a solid 30 minutes. And then Stephen Bay, we just did like a little special segment just for you.
You.
So We'll be back with more Horror Movie Night in just a week. Don't worry. Just hold tight. We'll be there soon. And you know what? I want to put this out into the ether. I mentioned it already once before. HMNpodcast@gmail.com. I'm thinking, even though our episodes are getting way longer than they ever used to be, I think that we could get them maybe 5-10 minutes longer. I want us to read an email from a listener if we can once a week. But in order to do that, we need an influx of emails. So if you've ever had a thought about a show, you want to make a joke about us, you have a question, whatever it is, hmmpodcast@gmail.com. We're just going to go through there. The ones that make me laugh or the ones that are interesting, quick little discussions, we'll do one email an episode. We'll start that after episode 350. We'll get through the next couple episodes. But hey, give us your hot takes, your thoughts, whatever. We'll discuss it. We'll discuss it. Unless we think it's trash, then we just won't read it at all. But so you know, you got to step it up a little bit. But all right. And don't send us your movie recommendations. We don't want your movie recommendations. We'll tell you when it's time for those.
I have a Tubi list full of them. I don't need your shit.
But we'll be back with more Horror Movie Night next week. Bye.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network. You're listening to the Geekscape Network.